A conversation with Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew. Maine Governor Paul LePage wants to make cuts to some health and welfare programs and spend the savings on what he believes are more important services. The changes are part of a two-year budget proposal that could affect thousands of poor and elderly Mainers. It includes cuts to the Medicare Savings Plan, to drugs for the elderly, and to general assistance and other welfare programs. The savings would be used to end the wait list for medical services for the elderly, to improve mental health services, and to fund nursing homes. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll speak with Mary Mayhew, Commissioner of Health and Human Services, and the person tasked with implementing the proposed changes. And we want to hear from you. Which services do you believe Maine people need? And do you think it's okay to cut some programs to pay for others? Commissioner Mary Mayhew, First News. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Maine Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew concluded a recent op-ed for the Bangor Daily News with this statement, quote, "We have finally bailed out the boat and are now charting a new course toward a sustainable welfare system that no longer tries to be all things to all people, but instead focuses on keeping its promises to the truly needy for whom its services were originally intended," end quote. Today, Commissioner Mayhew joins me to talk about the LePage administration's vision for reprioritizing some state programs, cutting some, bolstering others, and to answer your questions. Commissioner Mary Mayhew, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Keith. Glad to be here.
I want to start with a bit of news that ask your comment on. Your department has agreed to pay a former employee $142,000+ as part of a settlement of a federal whistleblower suit. This employee claimed that she was asked to shred documents. She said she didn't want to do that and was harassed and bothered for refusing to do that. Those documents were related to a Healthy Maine Partnerships program. Any comment on that settlement today?
Pursuant to the settlement, I cannot comment, though I can indicate that we are required to issue a statement to the press, and we will be doing so.
Okay. Today sometime, or?
Likely
today. Thank you for that. We're here actually to talk, of course, about the budget. It's a big document, and the DHHS budget is really the lion's share of this entire $6.3 billion budget that the governor has put forward, something around 3.2 or somewhere around there. So we're talking about a lot of what the state spends are on services, taking care of people, helping people who are struggling get by. It's a really big department, needless to say. How much, first of all, what is the net change in your budget this year as opposed to last year? Is it being cut? Is it growing or kind of staying the same?
So just to put it in perspective, when you combine with the federal funding for the Department of Health and Human Services, it's a $3.4 billion annual budget. And as we have been addressing some of the significant financial challenges confronting this agency over the last several years, I think it's important to note that for more than a decade, this agency has been reeling from one financial crisis to the next. And for anyone, an individual in their personal budget and a business, you don't plan well when you are in a constant state of financial crisis. So what has been so critically important to Governor LePage has been to stabilize this financial foundation so that we could appropriately plan. Maine has one of the oldest populations in the country. The demand for services, specifically in the Medicaid program, will be continuing to increase so that we can effectively meet the needs of our elderly. So it was critical that we move away from this crisis financial management to a place where we can align our limited resources with those core priorities rather than continuing to bail out the boat. So in this budget represents the results of having made some difficult choices over the last several years to stabilize that financial foundation, to commit to paying our bills on time, to stop the accumulation of massive debt to hospitals, and to begin to really look at what this safety net program needs to be structured. And so in this budget, we have a small ask rather than the $50, $100 million shortfalls that this state has been accustomed to for 10, 15 years.
$220 million in 2011.
Exactly. As we were struggling to replace a loss of federal funds that evaporated after the stimulus funds ended. So unlike those years, we are frankly coming in and proposing significant investments. We don't have a massive shortfall. We are looking at how do we provide critical resources to nursing homes. As an example, more than $24 million that we are putting forward to invest in our nursing homes. We've certainly had nursing homes that have closed over the last several years because, as one nursing home owner said to me, we've been on a starvation diet for years where Medicaid's reimbursement have not kept pace with our costs of care.
So, and on that issue, when we say the money is going to nursing homes, what technically does that mean? Is that in reimbursements for services?
Correct. So last year, the legislature actually passed legislation dictating the reimbursement approach to nursing homes to update their reimbursement to be more reflective of their current costs. Unfortunately, the legislation, the legislature did not provide all of the funds that were necessary to meet that statutory directive, and it was only one-time money that they did find. So we needed to make sure in this budget that we came up with permanent, ongoing increases for nursing home Medicaid reimbursement so that they can certainly keep their doors open, but also commit to the kind of quality care that we want to see in nursing homes for certainly our most vulnerable elderly who need to be able to depend on those services.
And we'll look at how you want to pay for that. But I want to back up a little bit and look at how we got here. You said at the outset here, for the first time in a long time, there's been no gap to deal with, so you could go right to policy changes. How did you do that? What were the big, you had to make some cuts to get here. What did you do to assure that you had enough money to work with?
Right. So for many years, the answer has been to balance the Medicaid program, unfortunately, on the backs of providers. So it was either, in the case of hospitals, their bills were not being paid on time. For physicians, their rate of reimbursement was inadequate to the extent that some physicians either closed their practice to Medicaid patients or limited the number of Medicaid patients that they would see. And we've obviously talked about nursing homes. So what we looked at certainly was the governor had to come in and increase, which is also often lost, because we had to replace the lost federal funds. Maine had received over $600 million over 3 years in temporary federal funding from the Medicaid program. That all ended in June of 2011. So one of the first things the governor had to do was actually increase substantially the state funding for Medicaid. And also committing to paying our bills on time, significant funds were put into the budget to pay hospitals on a real-time basis. But we also looked at right-sizing the program. Maine's enrollment in little more than a decade grew from 180,000 people on the program to, at its peak, 354,000 people on the program. So there were serious debates in the legislature that addressed enrollment and rolled back, in several cases, our coverage so that we would be, frankly, more in line with the rest of the country.
And you were focusing on what you consider to be able-bodied people, childless people. Who were those that you thought could be trimmed from the rolls to save the money?
Well, certainly Maine, and frankly, Maine has an experience that many states lack as these other states contemplate the massive Medicaid expansions under the Affordable Care Act. Maine had expanded back in early 2000, particularly to, as you just mentioned, childless adults, but also expanded our coverage to parents that greatly exceeded the federal minimum requirements. The expansion to childless adults was an optional population that Maine covered. And when we did that, we experienced significant growth in the enrollment, but also the cost of the program doubled from $1.2 billion in the year 2000 to today, $2.5 billion. And those costs, again, at the same time that the program was increasing and the costs were increasing, we were neglecting some of these core services and programs, certainly the reimbursement rates to ensure that when you give someone a card, they actually have access to a doctor. But worse, Keith, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, people that we would certainly acknowledge are the most vulnerable, most dependent on the state, they've been languishing on wait lists for services in their homes, in their communities. So Maine has been a leader in deinstitutionalizing, closing Pineland. But when you do that, you also need to make the investment in the community services, the community resources, to appropriately meet the needs of these individuals.
You were also trying to get off the rolls. It was at 18 and 19-year-olds, and that was you were challenging that in court, and that's you've asked now the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in on a lower court ruling that went against the state. Can you explain where we are in that process?
So Maine also had a coverage group that we defined as children. And because of, under the Affordable Care Act, there is what is known as a maintenance of effort requirement, which stipulates to a state that you cannot change your eligibility for any group pertaining to children until the year 2019. Now, meanwhile, Maine wasn't receiving any additional funds to cover this population. We have a budget that actually has to be balanced, unlike the federal government. We can't print money, we can't borrow. And so what we're arguing is not only should the state have absolutely the right to manage its Medicaid program, to make decisions, and this, of course, was a decision that the legislature agreed with and adopted. It's been rejected by the federal government, and we are pursuing and have pursued the federal government to reverse their decision. And now we are looking at taking this to the Supreme Court. I think it's also something for other states to pay close attention to, because for states that are saying, well, we'll expand, but when we can't afford it anymore, we're going to roll back that coverage. And the fact that we have Washington telling us that we can't roll back this coverage should be a lesson to those states today.
So while you await that decision, you've proposed in this budget a number of other series of other cuts that you hope will be able to fund the improvements to services elsewhere. I wonder if we could talk about some of those. One of the most controversial, I guess, if you'll call it that, is around the smoking programs. Your take is that the existing program doesn't work as effectively as it could, and you'd like to move away from it and focus on primary care as the source of helping people quit this habit.
So the money that you're referencing is as a result of a lawsuit that was filed by the states against the tobacco companies years ago, arguing that many of the states and their Medicaid programs were bearing the brunt of tobacco-related illnesses. So that is known as the tobacco settlement. And here in Maine, the funds are part of the Fund for a Healthy Maine. And yes, in our budget, we are proposing to take $10 million a year and transfer that into the Medicaid program to support increased funding for primary care doctors. As we look at the results of our incidence of tobacco use in Maine, very little has changed in more than a decade. And what is of serious concern to this administration is that the rate of tobacco use among Medicaid members is more than double that of the general population at over 46%. So what we are looking at is what is going to be the best and most appropriate intervention to truly help manage that chronic disease and to manage early intervention and prevention. And we believe that that engagement can be supported in a primary care practice.
A couple of other programs, drugs for the elderly, which has got some attention. Obviously, because, you know, opponents saying, well, why would you take money away from elderly to buy drugs? Explain what you're doing there and why.
Well, that is tied to a much larger initiative, and it's an initiative that's been in front of the legislature several times, and it relates to, again, the massive growth over many years in the state's Medicaid program, greatly exceeding the federal minimum requirements. And the proposal related to drugs for the elderly is actually tied to another proposal, which is trying to align Maine's program with the federal minimums. Maine is one of only two states, Maine and Connecticut, that exceed the federal minimum requirements related to a program that requires Medicaid to support the purchase of Medicare coverage for some of Maine's seniors. And again, in the effort to align and appropriately prioritize Maine's limited resources, we are proposing this alignment so that we can make the investments. So the people that I spoke about, the individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities that are on wait lists, we need $46 million over 2 years, just in state dollars, to address those individuals' needs. And I want to just point out, Keith, who we're talking about here, because many families and people throughout the state can appreciate, we're talking about a 75-year-old couple with a 50-year-old adult son with Down syndrome. They've been caring for him at home his entire life. Their health is failing, and he is in need of greater services and supports, and he's been on a wait list. And those are some of the many priorities. If you think as well about the number of children who are being diagnosed with autism, and as they graduate from high school, they're going into an adult system that is not prepared to effectively meet their needs, and they've also been going on wait lists. So those are some of the critical priorities that we believe need serious investment.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about the proposals to cuts in general assistance and several other welfare programs, and again, why those should have less priority and what should be what should take more priority under your plan. And of course, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation with Commissioner Mary Mayhew is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do CEI, flexible financing and development services for small and medium-sized businesses, economy, equity, environment, ceimaine.org.
This week on Morning Edition, we have an extraordinary look inside Iran. We're listening to people in a country on the verge of change.
I have been crying within myself sometimes to see such huge opportunities in this country, the benefits of which should go to the people.
What a more open Iran could mean for the world. Tune in to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition each weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Today, we have another MPBN Twitter Chat, and as our series of Twitter Chats with some of the voices and faces you know so well continues, fun and informative, today's MPBN Chat this afternoon at 2 o'clock is with Krista Tippett, host and executive producer of On Being, which airs Sunday mornings at 6 here on MPBN Radio. To join the conversation, just tweet using the hashtag MPBNChats, an MPBN Twitter chat with Krista Tippett, host of On Being, this afternoon at 2. Again, the hashtag is MPBNChats.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, my guest is Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew. And of course, we always want to hear from you as well. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to ask you about the vision for what has been a priority for the LePage administration, which is welfare reform. It continues in this budget, specifically almost $15 million out of General Assistance, TANF, and SNAP. Those are acronyms that describe welfare programs. But talk generally here about why $15 million and why to those specific programs.
Well, let's take a step back as well to what the governor has long said, which is he believes in focusing on prosperity and not poverty, that our goal needs to be how we provide people with a way out of poverty, to really address what has become generational poverty, generational dependency on these programs. And so it is all tied together, both in terms of what we just talked about, in terms of what had existed prior to this administration of out-of-control spending in Medicaid that was robbing resources from other priorities within DHHS, within other state agencies, and certainly adding to the tax burden of this state. And as the governor addresses his global vision for improving this state, it is about generating an improved economy that can attract and retain employers. So when we think about our efforts to assist individuals in poverty, it is about helping them on that pathway to a job, that is the ticket out of poverty, to be able to support people with the resources that they need, the temporary assistance. So you mentioned TANF, the temporary assistance for needy families. It is considered an employment-focused program dictated by the federal government. And we've failed. Maine is facing over $20 million in federal fines, penalties, because for years prior to this administration, we have failed to meet our work participation rates. So the proposals that are in the budget to further reform Maine's welfare programs are both about not only tightening the belt and becoming financially having financial integrity and management of these programs, but it is also about continuing to support the efforts to reduce the tax burden of the state, to create opportunity for an improved economy that can provide good paying jobs with benefits for individuals and families so that they can support themselves, as individuals clearly want to be able to do.
All right, the lines are full. The number again, 800-399-3566. Our guest today, DHHS Commissioner Mary Mayhew. It's hard for me to say that. I may have to find another way to say it. Let's go to Erica in Windham. Hi, Erica.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a caregiver for an older family member, and as are several of my friends, and we are all alarmed by the proposed cuts to the Drugs for the Elderly program and the Medicare Savings Program. I was wondering if you could please explain the rationale for these cuts, and especially since they're going to negatively impact Maine's most vulnerable and, in some cases, helpless citizens.
Well, I appreciate the question, and I think the challenge that we all face, again, this is a $2.4 billion annual program, and for years, as I said, there have been many priorities that have been neglected. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities, our elderly, frankly, have also been on waiting lists for critical services in their homes, that for many of us who are dealing with aging parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, the first challenge we face is how to support them as long as possible in their homes. And yet we have a program, home-based care, that has had wait lists, that the program has not been adequately funded. Maine's Medicare Savings Plan is, as I said, it is an outlier compared to the rest of the country. And this is, by the way, this is a requirement of the Medicaid program that we pay for the premiums for Medicare, which is fascinating, that the federal government is not providing greater support for that requirement. But Maine is one of only two states that exceed the federal minimum requirements. We're simply arguing that to balance across all of our competing priorities, Maine should be in line with those federal requirements. It does not mean, however, that we're not continuing to look at how to appropriately and effectively support and meet the needs of our seniors across many programs, both the Medicare Savings Plan as well as Drugs for the Elderly.
Erica?
Yes. Thank you for your answer. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right, Erica, thanks for your call. Let's go to Renee in Hollowell. Hi, Renee.
Good afternoon. Thank you for my call. I, too, am questioning why 60,000, approximately, seniors would be taken off their Medicaid Part B in reference to giving the nursing homes more money They did receive money last year, and any poll that is ever taken, people want to stay in their homes. They don't want to go to a nursing home. So how do you jeopardize one group in favor of another? Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I appreciate the question. I just want to clarify, on the nursing homes, the money that was provided last year was one-time funds. Those did not continue on. So it was critical that we were able to provide ongoing funds to permanently increase reimbursement for nursing facilities. And I completely agree that individuals do, in fact, want to stay home as long as possible. Though there are many programs that we believe need to be a priority that, unfortunately, the federal Medicaid program does not support. So basic services and supports in someone's home, like caring for providing meal preparation, house cleaning, those are not services that are typically reimbursable under the Medicaid program. They require 100% commitment by the state to support those services, and we are absolutely determined to provide that reimbursement and to support that in our budget. But there are, as I've said, many competing priorities and challenges, and we are focused on balancing all of those priorities and truly believe that this is an appropriate change that is in alignment with some of the other critical priorities that must be funded if we are going to ensure that this program, as a safety net program, is functioning as it needs to.
Is this plan, as it was laid out, really what the governor and you see as, you know, this is your wish list, this is how it should be? Or is there, to some extent, a little bit of putting in a grand piano in the budget here, or putting in extremes at the end of what you'd like to see, knowing that it's going to go through the rigor of the scrutiny of the legislature, and you'll come out with something that's palatable? Is that part of the game you play, or do you really just say, no, this is our vision, please enact it as is?
Yeah, we're not playing a lot of games with the development of this budget. And again, as we've said earlier, because we didn't face a $50, $100 million shortfall, $200 million shortfall in this budget, we were able to spend a significant amount of time evaluating comprehensively the Medicaid program and other areas within the Department of Health and Human Services budget to develop this proposal with the governor that really is reflective of the priorities, both in terms of investment in, as we've talked about, nursing homes, addressing the $46 million that's needed to deal with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities that have been on wait lists, the investment in primary care. You know, the challenge that we face in ever-increasing healthcare spending, if we don't begin to invest in primary care to better manage people with chronic diseases, to help reduce inappropriate or preventable use of the emergency departments, preventable admissions and readmissions to hospitals, we're going to see ever-escalating healthcare costs. So this proposal is very much in alignment with where the governor wants to be for this safety net program. Again, if you provide a card to someone, but a physician isn't willing to see a Medicaid patient because their rates of reimbursement are so low, or nursing homes close in rural parts of the state, what are you actually providing through this program?
So do you think the debate will be around, not so much, for example, the wisdom of moving toward primary care to help prevent some of these chronic diseases, or funding the nursing homes, that people will agree with that, the fight will be over to how to pay for it?
It's always about that, but just tough decisions have to be made, and we've made a lot of difficult decisions. And unfortunately, you're not seeing a lot of headlines these days about the Department of Health and Human Services, which frankly, I'm disappointed that we're not seeing a little bit more acknowledgement about what does it mean to get your financial house in order, and what are you then able to do to begin to look more than 6 months out. We need to be looking a year, 2 years, 5 years down the road. What is the system of care and the continuum of care that we need to be supporting? And are we producing better outcomes for the people of this state? And that's where we've been prioritizing in this budget. And yes, you're correct. It will absolutely be about how you pay for it. But it's true. We can't be all things to all people, and we've got to make difficult decisions and prioritize. And it can't simply be we've got to increase taxes to pay for ever-increasing spending in Medicaid.
Let's go to Stuart in Auburn. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, I'm just calling. I'd like to ask Ms. Mayhew a more personal question about her role at the department. And just I'm wondering how you go about balancing your, you know, clear obligation as a representative of, you know, the governor's philosophical, financial vision versus sort of the ethical obligations of being a social service provider and practitioner and overseeing, you know, that role, which, you know, many of us feel like probably trumps some of the financial obligations.
Well, actually, I think what the governor, his vision for this department is so much more aligned with fulfilling the mission of this social services agency. And frankly, I'm disappointed that that has been lost in the discussion about his proposals over the last several years. If you are failing to appropriately prioritize and manage your money, you're not fulfilling your mission. And again, when I look at people with intellectual and developmental disabilities that have failed to get appropriate services and supports, we're not meeting our mission. When a physician closes their practice to Medicaid patients, then we're not meeting our mission. When we are robbing funds from other parts of the department to plug holes in the Medicaid program, it is detracting from the mission. When you're constantly managing to a crisis, then you're not able to look comprehensively at the social services mission and be held accountable for whether or not you're actually fulfilling that responsibility.
What can you do to reassure us, though, that like actual trained and ethically obligated practitioners have a role in making some of these decisions and measuring outcomes and deciding whether or not services are appropriate?
Well, that is a fantastic question. And frankly, it's one of the areas that I wish there was more focus on. You know, so much of what gets covered in the press, they are the hot button issues. But what isn't reported on and discussed as broadly is the operational work of the department, which you are getting at, which I am passionate about. This is a large agency, 3,400 employees. And I take very seriously what you just described, which is the accountability and performance measures. And that, by the way, is new to this arena. It's, you know, relatively new, frankly, in healthcare generally. And that is, how do you define success? How do you measure? What data do you collect? And how do you demonstrate that you are improving outcomes, whatever the service area may be? We've spent the last several years working on identifying those measures and beginning that process of collecting data, training staff, working internally and externally on how we define success, how we begin to collect information around it, and how do we hold ourselves accountable. One of the areas that I can speak to that has been really foundational for us is our work around high utilizers of emergency department services. That requires an intense case management approach that we began statewide with all the hospitals and other community providers to address the needs of individuals who, frankly, have not been able to appropriately access primary care services. We've had amazing success. We are case managing over 1,000 individuals right now, and we have seen a dramatic improvement in both their ability to better access primary care services, but also have reduced the spend there by more than $9 million. But that is the epitome of a more client-centric approach that is looking more comprehensively at both their medical needs and their social needs. That is work that is going on throughout this very large department.
All right, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your calls. We'll try to get to Gregory in Bucksport, who's waiting patiently, and several others. The number again, 1-800-399-3566. Our guest is Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life, and Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success, famemaine.com.
The New Yorker magazine is celebrating its 90th anniversary this month. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the magazine's editor, David Remnick. He's the magazine's fifth editor, after Harold Ross, William Shawn, Robert Gottlieb, and Tina Brown. Remnick became a staff writer in 1992 and the editor in 98. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Alternative Radio. Today's speaker is Cornel West, who speaks on love and justice. Cornel West has taught at Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and the University of Paris. He's now teaching at Union Theological Seminary in New York. Among his many books are Race Matters and The Rich and the Rest of Us. That's Cornel West on Alternative Radio, coming up at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Mayhew. We invite you to join the conversation. As always, the number 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. And just as I was about to go to Greg in Bucksport, he disappeared. So we will instead go to Patrick in Portland. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a policy analyst at the Maine Heritage Policy Center here in Portland, and I have a question on general assistance. DHHS has talked a lot about the need to get a handle on excessive GA spending, but do you have any information or insight as to why Portlanders are allowing such high levels of GA spending, or any insight into their decision-making, or why they're just spending so much more than every other city and town in Maine?
Well, it's a great question, and I appreciate it. We certainly have been sharing a lot of our data analysis around the general assistance spending, and Portland is absolutely an outlier. While we have seen some work to manage the general assistance spend in the other large municipalities in Maine, Portland has continued to increase, and certainly they occupy the lion's share of the state funding for general assistance. The program overall has grown dramatically over the last several years, and certainly we have a proposal in the budget to make some needed reforms to the program. Part of the challenge that we face in the current structure of the program is that depending on how much a municipality spends, they can trigger a 90-10 match, which is somewhat of a perverse incentive to quickly spend to trip that 90-10 match. Only Bangor, Lewiston, and Portland have historically benefited from that. So our proposal is intended to flip that on its head and provide all municipalities up front with a 90% match up to a certain cap. In terms of Portland's specifically, we certainly have larger concerns about their approach to eligibility determination and have been evaluating that and sharing some of those concerns with the city of Portland.
Let's go to Cape Elizabeth and Sue. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I would like to ask about asylum seekers. Ms. Mayhew has already said that Maine has an older population, and I understand that that obviously needs more services. But another consequence of having an older population is that we need younger people in the workforce. And asylum seekers meet this need, and they don't need help for a very long time, only while they get on their feet, because they're mostly educated already. They're not used to being dependent on other people, and they can't work when they first get here. So, and they're also legal while they're waiting for their asylum request to be, you know, for a decision. So, I mean, I'm wondering, why does it make sense, as I gather the governor wants to do, is to deny them temporary assistance?
So, I'm not exactly sure in terms of the program that you're referring to that the governor has made the statement. If you are talking
about asylum seekers are cut out of GA, right?
So that is simply complying with federal law. Federal law prohibits.
Well, that's in the courts at the moment. So that doesn't, I mean, that may answer it or it may not answer it.
Well, so it is absolutely, our approach is simply to comply with the federal requirement. We are not attempting to interpret immigration policy or to address the approach taken in terms of determinations around asylum seekers. This is simply a compliance with federal requirements, both in terms of the General Assistance Program and then anywhere else that there are restrictions on state or federal funds.
Okay, but so are you telling me that if the courts decide against the governor's stand on this, that you will be working to reinstate or work for asylum seekers to receive GA?
Certainly, I am interested in what transpires out of this litigation. I'm not prepared at this point to comment on whether or not we would be seeking an appeal.
All right, let's go to, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ellen in Lebanon, Maine. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, Ellen.
Go ahead. Please. My question goes back to the DEL, and my concern is because...
Ellen. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. My concern still is because we're trying to work on a bipartisan way of keeping people in their homes and preventing long-term care, or even caring for them better in nursing homes and by providing more money, is that by cutting people off the DEL, many people will not be able to afford medications, and therefore they won't be on it, and so therefore they're more at risk of rehospitalization, deteriorating health, and nursing home care. So I guess that's truly my concern, is how do we balance that?
No, and what you just described is what we are challenged to do every single day, is to balance those demands, those priorities against other needs and demands in this ever-increasing budget. Certainly in terms of ensuring appropriate access to medications, the Drugs for the Elderly program is one. Certainly if someone is on Medicaid, that already is providing reimbursement to medications, to pharmacy. There are other programs, and the issue is, what is Maine's state government's role? How do we maximize other available resources through federally qualified health centers, et cetera, and to try and balance that against what the state does need to be funding.
So the department is essentially saying it is sort of betting that reducing the Drugs for the Elderly program will not result in the bubble popping up elsewhere in terms of cost. That's your best guess, is that you can save money there without just simply shifting cost elsewhere.
Well, unfortunately, this stems back to decisions that were made many years ago that were part of another bet, which was, if we expand our Medicare savings plan, which again is Medicaid paying for premiums, coinsurance, and deductible for Medicare, that if we expand that we will save money from what the state had been spending through the Drugs for the Elderly program. But unfortunately, the costs associated with it and the crossover, the payments to hospitals and to other providers for the coinsurance and deductible has increased dramatically. And the number of individuals enrolled in this part of the program has increased significantly. So we do need to balance against the other critical services within the program we're not operating in a vacuum here. And what continues to be ignored are fundamental mandatory requirements of this program. We just settled a lawsuit for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who were not being timely, their needs were not being timely met. We know we have failed to keep pace with the cost of nursing homes. Those are core mandatory requirements. The hospital bills, $400 million, $750 million in debt owed to hospitals, another core service that was not being appropriately budgeted. That has to be part of the overall equation.
Now, politically, the governor tried to eliminate the drugs for the elderly program a couple of years ago. That met with great resistance from Democrats. This is a scaled-back version. You think politically it has more of a chance, obviously.
You know, obviously these are issues that are emotional. They are going to create a lot of discussion and debate, as we would expect and appreciate, and we look forward to talking about these. But talking about these in the context of this entire program and the state's ability to appropriately meet these needs. One of the areas that isn't in our budget, because we couldn't immediately come up with the funds, is what we are paying to home care, direct care workers. The increasing need to support people in their homes, we need to be able to attract and retain quality direct care staff, and their wages will affect that. And Medicaid is a big payer. So if Medicaid's not paying enough to help support the wages that are needed for that staff, that is a glaring hole that is still very much a part of, unfortunately, the Medicaid budget.
Let's go to Tom in Brunswick. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
My issue relates specifically to the handicap, a.k.a. cap in hand, and on the help they need and the skills they've developed over many years. And in some cases, were ambulatory, have many years of experience. In other cases, they've got college degrees with help from voc rehab. And in many cases, there would be assets to a lot of the businesses out there, especially considering the demographics show a lot of the workers are leaving the workforce. I was thinking, why can't these businesses, since they're licensed by the state many times, i.e. dentists, real estate agents, be accessible so that these limited ambulatory folks can work and help the businesses, because they're skill-based and there's a need in business?
Well, I love your question. I'm not sure how much of it necessarily is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Health and Human Services, but it is something that I have spoken at length with the Commissioner for the Department of Labor, Commissioner Paquette. You know, as she looks at workforce development for Maine, to your point specifically, their plan is called We Need Every Mainer to truly meet the job demands in Maine, and particularly to look at individuals with physical disabilities and continue to make the needed investments to support increased access to employment throughout Maine, to support vocational rehabilitation and to create the necessary pathways so that individuals certainly can take advantage of that, but also that employers are equally encouraged to move in that direction.
Only a couple of minutes left here. I'm going to go to Lynn in Casco. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I think she's pretty much answered my question, but I just wanted to double check. So am I to understand that there are going to be some funds that will be helping the intellectually and developmentally challenged in the future? I take care of my mentally challenged sister. She's been on a waiting list for 10 years to go into a group home. I've retired, but I've had to take a full-time job because I get no financial assistance to take care of her. I wondered if this is something that's going to be addressed within the next year or two.
Yes, you know, I'm not. Thank you for your question, and I truly appreciate what you've done and how difficult it can be. And certainly, if there's more that we can do, I would encourage you to call my office, because I'd love to be able to follow up. But what we have in the budget is over $46 million to support people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and to continue to eliminate the wait lists for those services. So for people who need 24/7 care in their home or in a group home, that would absolutely be funded through that. We also, the governor has also committed significant funds, over $10 million for people with serious and persistent mental illness to better support access to services in the community. So those are two critical priorities. But please do call my office if there's anything that we can do to further help you.
Lynn, best of luck. We're going to run out of time here. So obviously, there's a lot of hammering and back and forth that's going to happen here with this throughout the weeks and months ahead.
And we'll be there the entire time.
We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
It's a busy day. Commissioner Mary Mayhew, Commissioner of Maine's Health and Human Services Department. John Keimel ran the board today. Our intern, Moses Small, answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about recognizing and treating drug addiction. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.